I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the ongoing efforts to make Indianapolis a more walkable city. We'll discuss why making cities walkable matters and how we go about doing it. My guests are national expert Chris Lineberger, a real estate, urban planning guru, and co-author of Foot Traffic Ahead. He also was a keynote at a conversation about Indy's walkable future. And Kim Irwin, executive director of Health by Design, which is working on the Walkways Initiative to make Indy more walkable and get more people walking. Also, Bill Arrett, commercial real estate broker with Avison Young and a board member of the Central Indiana Regional Transportation Authority. To join the conversation, please call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, or find us on social media. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about what it will take to create a walkable city here in Indianapolis. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Christopher B. Lineberger, who is real estate and urban planning guru and is the co-author of Foot Traffic Ahead. He was in Indianapolis for actually a couple of speeches that we're going to be talking about. Also with us is Bill Arrett. He is a commercial real estate broker with Avison Young and a board member of the Central Indiana Regional Transportation Authority. And Kim Irwin, who's executive director of Health by Design, which is working on the Walkways Initiative to make Indy more walkable and get more people walking. Welcome, all of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to start first. Chris, what brought you to town, and what did you say to the folks once you got here?
Well, we did this national survey of the 30 largest metros, and we looked at Metro Indianapolis to understand where you're growing and what's the future looking like. And then we compared those 30 metros to one another. And certainly Metro Indianapolis is moving towards a more walkable urban future. You've got seven what we call walkable urban places, or walk-ups for short, and they're doing very well in the marketplace. They've got 33% rent premiums over the drivable suburban competition. And you are gaining market share in your walkable urban places. This is for the first time in 60 years. So in this real estate cycle, in this economic cycle, that the market has fundamentally turned towards more walkable urban. And those pent-up demand is evidenced by those rent premiums. Having said that, you're still not in the top tier compared to your competition throughout the rest of the country. One of the things we know about great walkable urban places is that it attracts more highly educated workers, and that leads to higher GDP per capita. And on both those metrics, you're sort of down towards the bottom compared to your competition. So good news is you're moving in the right direction. The bad news is that there's a lot more to do, but boy, there's so much activity in the market just driving around here. I mean, there are cranes everywhere that are feeding that demand. It's going to be a great economic base for you over the next generation.
What are the most walkable cities in the country?
Well,
what are the standards, would you say?
The most walkable metros, and again, we're looking at the entire metro region, is New York. Mm-hmm. But that is overweighted by Manhattan Island. Manhattan Island is where 90% of their walkable urbanism is. That's 0.3 of 1% of their land and 8% of their population. It's so intensely urban that it just tips the scales. But the more likely models for Indianapolis are to compare yourself to the Washington, D.C.'s, the Boston's, the Seattle's, the Portland's. These are the most walkable urban places. And these walkable urban places are also the home of the future knowledge economy. There's a real correlation between walkable urbanism and the 21st century knowledge economy. And again, you're towards the bottom of the list. But again, the good news is that you're heading in the right direction and you can learn from these other metros.
Are there other places in the Midwest or in the region that, because I noticed the cities were on either coast, you know, on the either the East Coast or the West Coast, you know, in terms of, and I guess I probably should ask before we even get to whether it's Midwest, is this somewhat a coastal phenomenon? I mean, you can make an argument that New York, Manhattan's walkability evolved somewhat organically because mm-hmm. they literally ran out of room to park automobiles and all of that. Has this been a coastal phenomenon, and are there places in the Midwest that are making headway?
It certainly started as a coastal phenomenon 5, 10, 15 years ago, but now it's really sweeping the Sun Belt. The places that have moved the most aggressively over the last few years has been Los Angeles, Phoenix, Dallas, Atlanta, Miami. They're all putting in transit. They're all taking advantage of the transit they have. Los Angeles is the real surprise one because they have taxed themselves three, 4 years back, $40 billion to put back in their transit system. They used to have the world's largest, longest transit system in 1945, ripped it out by 62. They're now putting it back in. Their fall ballot measure will up that $40 billion to $120 billion. They have five lines under construction right now. You can now live in Los Angeles without a car. And so that is just propelling them towards the future. Now, here in the Midwest, it's a tale of two metros, that you've got the Midwest towns like Indy, like Cincinnati, like Columbus, that many people in those towns believe that it's a God-given right that they will be driving the rest of their lives and I'm never going to change. But we're seeing changes in all of those towns. The turnaround in downtown Cincinnati, over the Rhine, you know, uptown has been quite remarkable. Columbus has a lot of great places. Dublin out in the suburbs, OSU, Short North, downtown, German Village. So there's a lot of places that, quite honestly, they're all in front of you. Mm-hmm. And if you don't offer the market what they want, they're going someplace else. The other tale in the Midwest that's important to note is that Detroit, as far as forward-looking indicators, is the third fastest-growing walkable urban place in the country. Downtown, Midtown, New Center, Birmingham, Ann Arbor are making remarkable strides.
Gotten a question from a listener via Facebook, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. It says, it's great they're making the city more walkable, but we need to change the culture of the drivers' mentalities. I was just downtown for the Strawberry Festival, and all the cars seem to still think they have the right of way when pedestrians are in the street and even crosswalks. We're all chuckling here, but is that one of the larger... I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts on that, because some of this is a public policy thing and an investment of infrastructure, but that doesn't necessarily... It's not like Field of Dreams. It isn't necessarily, if you build it, they will come. There has to be a change of mindset. Kim, I'd like your thoughts.
Sure, absolutely. So I often say about our work with Health by Design and walkways is an extension of that, that as much as we are trying to get more infrastructure on the ground, have bikeways in place, get more sidewalks, paint more crosswalks, this is absolutely about changing culture and about helping people, number one, stop and think for a moment about the opportunity to walk. Hey, could I walk to dinner when I go? Could we walk to the park tonight instead of getting in our car to drive? That kind of thing. But it's absolutely about raising the, frankly, respectability of people who are walking for whatever reason, in whatever location, and collectively as drivers, as people who are walking, as cyclists, as transit riders, looking out for each other. Safety is a fundamental issue. We are in the middle of an analysis of pedestrian crashes, and probably we're still working through the data, but we think we have about 2 pedestrians hit per day in this city. And typically they're not fatal, so they don't necessarily make the news, and that's good news, but it is way too high of a number, and we've seen fatalities increase over time. And so that safety aspect is critical and needs to be the driver of that, because it's just, it is a tragedy. And it is not just a result of having poor infrastructure in places, but it is very much a result of us just not being respectful of people walking.
And I think this also applies to the bike riders as well, obviously. And then Chris mentioned it, the empowerment of getting in your car. People's personas change when they step into the car and put that seatbelt on, that this is my lane, this is my road, and I'm empowered to do what I want to do. And that's
a
hard thing to change.
Yeah. The nature of aggression. You mentioned, Chris, that this has really accelerated in the past 10 to 15 years. What was the catalyst? Or what were the catalysts, more likely, that it wasn't just one?
Well, certainly the turnaround of some of our downtowns throughout the country started in the mid-90s when we had the unexplained drop in crime, but then also the rise of the millennials. The young people want this. This is a market demand that the young people want. You know, the young people want to go to colleges that are in towns. They want to live when they leave colleges. This is basically a Seinfeld sort of way of living. And they bought into it. And there's a lot of young people not getting driver's license, a lot of people who just don't think about moving out to the suburban subdivisions where they were raised. So that's the main mover. And again, it's also the knowledge economy. The industrial economy needed to be drivable suburban for all sorts of reasons. Today's knowledge economy must take place in walkable urban places. And as I mentioned earlier, if you don't offer the market what it wants, it's going to go to Chicago, it's going to go to Detroit, it's going to go to Washington. So this is a fundamental economic issue. By the way, going back to the issue of right-of-ways, I just mentioned that 40% of your city is public-owned right-of-ways. They're owned by all of you. It's not owned by one class of citizen. And in the new U.S. transportation bill that just was signed by the president 6 months ago, there's a new public policy nationally called Complete Streets, which is in the bill. Every state must follow if they want federal funding. And basically, it recognizes that all of us own the streets, and they should be built for pedestrians, bicyclists, and the car and transit.
We are talking about how we make Indianapolis a more walkable city on No Limits today. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Carolyn has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Carolyn, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a two-part question. As a healthcare provider, I wonder if you're looking at the healthcare benefits for the community by adding these walkable communities to destinations that people need to and want to go, not only their workplace, but their grocery stores. And I know when I moved back to Indiana from San Diego. I moved to San Diego, I lost 50 pounds because I walked everywhere. And I moved back here and I purposely selected a community where I could walk to the things that I needed to get to. And the second part of my question is, as you're doing the planning for the sidewalks for the walking folks, are you looking at making them bike-friendly sidewalks? Because we know that concrete sidewalks are not bike-friendly, but the paved sidewalks are. And those are my questions.
Thanks very much for the call, Carolyn, and for the questions. We'll let Kim deal with the health piece of that.
Sure.
Health by design. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for the call and the questions. And fundamentally, health is a key aspect of this conversation. It certainly is the basis for the work we do as Health by Design. We know that walkable places correlate to healthier behavior. When people have a sidewalk near their house, when they have places to go, they will walk. And in addition, having places to go that are healthy places, so a full access grocery store where they can get fresh fruits and vegetables, a park as an example, other places to be active, healthcare facilities, medical facilities, those are extremely important destinations that people need to be able to walk to. So it's a great question. It's absolutely one of the things that we looked at in the pedestrian plan that was recently adopted by the city of Indianapolis. Health measures are included as our equity factors that factor into that, as well as the safety piece.
Right. Public health is critical to this debate. And the U.S. Surgeon General just had a call for action a few months ago. And he had mentioned that if walkability was a new pill, it'd be the miracle drug of the century. And we know it's crucial. I mean, one of the reasons we have the obesity epidemic in this country is because we become car drivers for the bulk of our transportation. I'm not against cars. It's just we don't want to be dictated that you must drive no matter where you're going.
I think real quick, Chris made a comment in his presentation this morning about those raising their hands that walk to school and what it looked like for our generation, Chris and I's generation, and what it looks like today.
Mine too.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Nobody raised their hand with their kids today walking to school. Nobody walks to school.
We are talking about creating a walkable city here in Indianapolis. My guests are Chris Lineberger, Bill Arrett, and Kim Irwin. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about creating a walkable city in Indianapolis. My guests are Christopher B. Lineberger, who's a real estate and urban planning guru and the co-author of Foot Traffic Ahead. He was in Indiana to speak to this subject yesterday and today. Bill Arrett, who's a commercial real estate broker with Avison Young and a board member of the Central Indiana Regional Transportation Authority, and Kim Irwin, executive director of Health by Design, which is working on the Walkways Initiative to make Indy more walkable and get more people walking. We've got a question from a listener named Angela via Facebook. If you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Angela says, I think a major difference is that we lack a light rail in Indy. I live in Greenwood and would, of course, do more walking in Indy if I could take a train there. I grew up in New York with the Long Island Railroad. I miss that. That gets us into the question, obviously, Bill, of mass transit here. But the larger question is, Angela, if I can broaden your point, is, how do we get to from where we are to making this a much more walkable city? I'll start with Chris first on that one.
Well, certainly transit is a key issue here because transportation drives development. It's the catalytic infrastructure. It's been that way for 6,000 years that we've been building cities, so it's not changing. And you've built a transportation system that is meant to drive drivable suburban development. And so you have to offer options. Right now you only have one option. You don't offer any other. And so you need to offer more options. And your ballot measure coming up in November is particularly crucial because you need to join the rest of the largest 30 metros that all have transit, except for Columbus. They all have transit now, and you're being left behind. And BRT, Bus Rapid Transit, will be a fabulous start for this. So you need to give people options, because if you can drop one car out of your household budget, similar to what you were doing when you were in New York, that car costs $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 per year to own, operate, park, insure, gas, maintain, pay off the debt service. That, if it translates into a house payment, is $150,000 of increased mortgage capacity. And that goes from a depreciable asset to an appreciable asset, will build net worth, and you'll have options in your life. You don't have to get rid of all your cars. Just get rid of one, and you'll have more options for your life.
Bill, let me step in. I mean, I'm assuming that CERTA has done some research on what the economic impact of mass transit would be.
I mean, we have tremendous examples in Portland, in Denver, in what's going on in Dallas, and Chris can even speak better to that, what the overall development, but there is tremendous development opportunities in the built environment around transit and transit stops. But I think a couple key words that I keep hanging on from Chris's presentations happens to be options. The market is demanding choice, and right now we aren't providing choices relative to people who don't want to own a car and get places, and people who do own a car. And then the other thing, that has to do with this is this social equity formula that's related to the cost of owning a car versus the opportunity of owning an appreciable asset like a really nice home somewhere. And that's a huge point that I think I've learned in Chris's report and presentation.
What I mean, do we have numbers, though, that Chris, that that would speak to what the impact would be? I mean, we know we've done shows on mass transit. We know what the cost is to implement it, and it's a significant number. What's the benefit on the back end?
Well, for one thing, it is not a significant cost when you compare it to the maintenance of the highways system. It's really a very small cost, and on what it's going to support as far as future economic development, because you build transit and any transportation system for economic development, and it pays off tremendously. In Portland, Oregon, when they put their first streetcar in, $55 million phase one, $3.5 billion of private investment along the line within 10 years. So we know it has huge payoffs. But for a family, bring it down to the family level, we looked at, in our research, a moderate income, low to moderate income family making 80% of your average median income. And you in this town right now, those people are paying the most of their per capita income on transportation. Moderate income people in metropolitan Indianapolis are paying more than anybody else in the country for your transportation budget. And that means that if you're a struggling family trying to make a living and you can't afford two cars or one car, I mean, how can you pull yourself up from your economic level if you basically are being priced out and you're spending 25, 30, 35% of your household income on transportation?
If you're just joining us, we are talking about walkability in Indianapolis. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I'm interested. I'm very favorable and supportive of a lot of what I hear. I think there are tremendous benefits to this idea of walkability. I am concerned about one thing, however, and I would like to hear your panel speak about what's the effect of all this on the question of poverty and poor people. Is this going to be another kind of massive displacement of places where the poor are at, and what's the consequence for them? I'd like to hear somebody address that, because I know that in some cities this is a bit of a struggle related to the larger question of gentrification, as it sometimes puts. So I'd just like to hear your panel comment on that, if I could. Thank
Great.
You.
Thanks very much for the call, David. Chris, please.
This is part of our study that we didn't just look at the economic benefits of walkable urbanism. We looked at the social equity side, and we define social equity as both housing costs as a percent of your household income, transportation costs, as I just mentioned, and accessibility to jobs for a moderate, low to moderate income household. And as far as housing goes in this town, low to moderate income households, it's cheap. You have cheap housing. But as I mentioned earlier, your transportation costs are the highest in the country for that, for those households. And your accessibility to jobs for those low to moderate income households is also the lowest in the country. So when you add that all up and you look at it from a national point of view, and this is going to be counterintuitive, and I know people are going to say I'm smoking something funny here, but
we can testify that you're not.
The most walkable urban places in the country, New York, Washington, San Francisco, Boston, Chicago, also are the most socially equitable. The housing costs higher, as I just mentioned, they do cost higher. But the transportation costs drop significantly, offsetting a large portion of that housing cost, and you have better accessibility to jobs. So walkable urban development creates a more socially equitable metropolitan area.
I know we've got to let you go so that you can catch a flight, but I wanted to ask one last question before you go. Is that the higher costs of housing the only significant cost associated with making a metro area more walkable, or are there others? I want to pick up on David's thing about, are the displacement costs when it comes to you know, gentrification and all of that sort of stuff.
Hey, you know, obviously when we change our cities, there's going to be displacement, and that's just life. And, you know, change always causes pain and it causes good things. But what we do know is that the housing costs, our numbers show that 70% of that gentrification premium that I just mentioned is caused by high land cost. Our research shows that you in Indianapolis use between 3 and 4% of your total metro land for walkable neighborhoods. 3 and 4%. If you made that 5 or 6%, you would take you would drop those premiums dramatically. There's no reason why land should cost so much in these walkable urban places. It's just that we don't build enough of them. We have pent-up demand, too much demand, not enough supply. We need to build more supply, which will in turn drive down those land prices.
Chris, thank you very much for spending time. Safe travels. And I wanted to throw a question to Kim, saying, to follow up on a previous caller, as a physician, I would recommend you work with all healthcare providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, therapists, etc., as well as schools and parent organizations to promote walking and biking at all healthcare visits and school meetings. This miracle of walking needs to be heard everywhere. Thanks for all you do to educate. You know, how much are we throwing at what amounts to a public education campaign now?
Sure. Well, thank you for that comment and the very important and kind words. So, you know, public education is a very important piece of this, and it's in many ways the easiest aspect and in other ways the hardest, right? And so we, again, through the Walkways Initiative, which is in the process and has been organizing walks that people can participate in. And we're looking for neighborhoods and organizations and businesses to be willing to lead walks to essentially get more people walking. We have a lot of great infrastructure in Indianapolis and in the metro area. So we want to take advantage of that and encourage people to walk, not just for transportation reasons, which is an easy way to get steps in during the day, but also to be intentional about it for health. We know that people do not, by and large, people do not get enough physical activity. And so looking at that as a risk factor, incorporating that into medical screenings, as was indicated, those are all very important to changing, again, that overall culture and creating what we're increasingly referring to as a culture of health. A culture of health so that things like walking to school, things like walking to lunch or to dinner or to the park or even for ice cream become very much more a part of what we do.
We are talking about walkability here in Indianapolis. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Nini has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
So I just wanted to further comment about cars. What I've observed in Indianapolis is people run red lights all the time in the city. And I personally think they do because nobody anticipates a pedestrian being on the road. And I think part of changing the culture also has to be stopping all these people who run red lights. That we literally, they're shocked when they see a pedestrian. And I try to walk a lot, and many times it's the cars trying to run a red light that I think are going to kill me. So that's just my comment. Thanks.
Thanks very much for the call and the comment. We've got sort of the other side. A listener named Barbara reached out to us via Facebook and says, you mentioned pedestrians being hit by cars and seem to make the assumption that it's always the driver's fault. I live in an area with no sidewalks and do a lot of walking myself in addition to driving. I've noticed many pedestrians on the wrong side of the street. They are facing away from traffic, wearing earbuds, or talking on their cell phone. Often they will be wearing dark clothes at dusk or later. My husband, going into work at 5 a.m., often is startled by people sauntering across the street in dark clothes and away from any lights. It's a miracle more are not hit. They don't know the rules of the road. Face traffic and cross at the intersections and be visible. How much of this is also about educating people about, you know, it sounds silly, but how you walk? I mean, it's one of the things I've had to drill with my kids. My grandfather emphasized to me, he was a hiker, you always walk facing traffic. Yes. So that you can see it coming.
Yes. Absolutely. Let's repeat that. You always walk facing traffic. You want to be looking at the cars coming at you. And it's extremely important to cross at safe places to cross, which in an ideal situation is a signalized intersection with a painted crosswalk. And you're walking, you know, you're crossing the street when you have the right of way to walk, the sign to walk. But the reality of this situation, and I really appreciate the comment, it's extremely important. And again, it's part of that overall conversation. But we don't make it easy for people to walk in a lot of places. We haven't provided the infrastructure. We haven't provided places to cross. Sometimes on some stretches of our busy, what we call arterial roadways, you can be essentially blocks between intersections where the expectation that people should cross is. And so it's very easy to point fingers in this work. It's very easy to think about things like dark-colored clothing or, not facing the right direction who has the right of way at any given point. But the reality is we all have a responsibility and we all have to commit to being cooperative, to being the best drivers we can be, to being the best pedestrians we can be, to being the best bicyclists we can be, and honestly making this better for everyone. We will not take care of what we need to if we continue to just assume that the other person is in the wrong.
Yeah. Same rules apply to the avid jogger. Yeah. Runner. I mean, you know, that. I think that's where I picked up on it. You having done that in the past a lot more than I do today, but it's you want to face traffic and you want to be careful and you want to wear bright clothes. And I can understand the caller being observant of that concern.
We've got we're talking about perceptions of walkers. I'm going to work in one more email from a listener named Bill. And if you want to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Bill says, great show. My comment is about the perception of walkers. I live in the center of Noblesville, and my two boys will be able to walk and do walk to every school they'll attend. This was a part of why we chose to live where we do. One thing I've come to realize is that people are suspicious of walkers, even our very safe Hamilton County City. Before Christmas this year, my 10-year-old son wanted to walk into town and deliver a letter to Santa. His house was on the square. It was 7 in the morning, and the square is just over 2 blocks away. He was reported to the police, and we had to deal with child services. The person who called the police remained anonymous to us. We're all good now, but it points out the perception of walkers and how powerfully our culture has shifted to a car-centered one. Yeah.
That's a big wow for me.
Yeah.
That's a wow.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I've heard that story in many, many times. It's indicative exactly how it was said, and it's frankly tragic. So I don't have a good answer. I wish, you know, we want these things to be fixed very easily. We want there to be one silver bullet, one magic answer that will solve these problems, and, you know, we can all get along in this shared space that Christopher referred to. But we all have a role, and we have to continue to, frankly, if we will all walk more, we will help change those perceptions and we'll help make that the norm so that it won't be so strange and alarming to have children.
A listener who didn't want to go on the air says if they want to make a city more walkable, they need to hire real pedestrians to consult, people who choose to walk to travel. Mm-hmm. Who all is involved in this process right now? I mean, that's a question primarily about inclusion. Bill, Kim?
I'm going to ahead and let you take that one as well, Kim.
Sure. No, well, thank you. So formally, the partnership that developed the Indianapolis Pedestrian Plan and that branded the Walkways Initiative was between the Marion County Public Health Department, the City of Indianapolis, and Health by Design. And over the last 9 months or so, we had a series of public meetings. We had a public survey that was more than 2,500 respondents, and there is an ongoing, campaign and also aspects of that campaign around safety that are in development. But you can always reach us at info@indywalkways.org with feedback or input or to invite us to come and talk to a group you're involved with. We'd welcome that.
And I would say that as it relates to my volunteer involvement with CERTA, Central Indiana Regional Transportation Authority, our goal is all types of transit. So bicycling, walking, mass transit, BRT, whatever it is, that's what we're trying to promote so that we can connect the region with the various forms. So
We are talking about walkability in Indianapolis. My guests are Christopher Leinberger, Bill Arrett, and Kim Irwin. I am John Krall. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about what it will take to create a more walkable city here in Indianapolis. My guests are Bill Arrett. He's a commercial real estate broker with Avison Young and a board member of the Central Indiana Regional Transportation Authority, and Kim Irwin, who's executive director of Health by Design, which is working on the Walkways Initiative to make Indy more walkable. We've gotten a question via Twitter, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. This is from a listener named Joseph. He says, and I'm going to throw this one to you, Bill. How do we bring those destinations into neighborhoods where we'd want to walk to? And he says, i.e. groceries, but businesses. How do you get them into neighborhoods so that they are within walkable distances?
Well, businesses like food service, particularly groceries, are rooftop driven. As most developers, and Chris would have mentioned in his presentation, so we have to create density. Density is what walk-ups and walkability are all about. So as we create the households, the density, the groceries will follow. And we have great signs of that right here in Indianapolis and downtown Indy, where right now we have two grocery stores, Marsh, the former O'Malley's location in Lockerbie, and the new Marsh at Axis, and a third grocery store that will come in on the new Flaherty and Collins Tower, a Whole Foods. So clearly the density that's been added to the market in the last 5-plus years, those types of commercial uses will be right behind.
We are talking about walkability here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Kathy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. What a great conversation.
Thank you. What's on your mind?
I am calling. I am a proud member of a community on the northeast side of Indianapolis near 62nd Street, where several neighborhood associations came together and through lobbying and working with local government, we now have a beautiful walking and bike path that runs east to west from Keystone to Allisonville. And now we can walk to the grocery store or ride a bike to the Glendale Library, or heading the other direction to John Strange Elementary School and Eastwood Middle School. So we're proud of that community that we've developed here in this part of town. The sad part is now Washington Township has decided that our elementary school is beyond fixable, and they're going to shut down our elementary school after we've created this wonderful feeling of community. So I don't know, that's not really a question, but a comment about how something so good can go so wrong, I guess. I will hang up the phone and turn my radio back on and see what y'all have to say about that.
All right. Thanks very much for the call and for sharing your story, Kathy. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, but that is part of it. It's not just, it is, to some degree, it seems to me Kathy's story speaks to this challenge of getting all of the oars pulling in the same direction here.
Well said. I think about, you know, the IPS story and the several closures that they went through in the 90s, and how important those facilities probably would be as we evolve now in this decade towards walk-ups. That is just a tough one, and maybe they'll rethink as things change going along in Washington Township schools, may rethink something like that. Kim, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I don't know anything about that exact situation. I actually hadn't heard it, so I appreciate the comment. But it is an extremely important component of this, and that is the land use side and how we choose to use land, where we place types of uses and important destinations. We have a formal partnership also with the city of Indianapolis around safe routes to school. So making it safer, easier, and frankly, fun for children to be able to walk and bike to school. We have really, with a few exceptions, very, very low rates of that, as was alluded to earlier. And there are a number of reasons. And one of those is what we call school siting. So where schools are located. And again, decades ago, most people attended a neighborhood school or a school that was in a reasonable proximity to where they lived. And I'll come back to the land use comment, but in addition to the school choice topic that's involved and how, you know, we have an increase in charter and magnet and other private types of schools, we just don't see that proximity anymore. And arguably there is a downside to that for sure.
But based on Chris's reports and all the studies and all the trends, those types of schools will come back. They should come back.
Yeah. And people will. Exactly. There is increasing demand for neighborhood-based services. And so through policy decisions, through working with administrations, you know, maybe there is an opportunity to think about if that building can't be salvaged, is there another area that can be used, or can that site be adapted in another way?
And we've gotten an email question from our regular listener, Marion. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Marion says, are considerations being made to develop walking areas in depreciated as well as affluent communities? Kim?
Could you go ahead and repeat that? I'm sorry, John.
Depreciated. Well, I think she means poor as well as wealthy. The perception, I think, at times is that walkable space is really a preoccupation of the, you know,
sure,
the upper middle class and above, sure, rather than others. Are there plans to get into poor neighborhoods and make them more walkable?
Right. So I can speak to that for a moment. So one of the things, and again, if we think specifically about Marion County and even the original town centers in the metropolitan area, those were designed inherently to be walkable spaces. And so much of Center Township is a very walkable. Now, we have issues of conditions, the maintenance of sidewalks. And so there are issues that come into play around safety and usability that come with that. It's an extremely important issue. And I think the social equity factors that Christopher was talking about earlier and how that plays into the analysis is very important. One of the things we didn't talk about earlier that I think is relevant, it's relevant to this conversation, and I think it gets to this question, is the idea of essentially preserving and preserving opportunity and being intentional about affordable housing as we continue to develop our transit lines and then develop around transit. And while I'm not aware myself of any specific things in place right now, that's there are policy decisions that can drive that. There are obviously development angles of development that matter, and maybe you can speak to that.
Well, what I think about is when I drive around the city and you see certain pockets, certain corners where you have these two or three story type little buildings. I'm thinking near Riverside Park, just on West 30th Street, or I'm thinking along East 10th Street, or I'm thinking certainly along East and West Washington Street. Those areas have been blighted for so long, and this whole concept of redevelopment and providing new supply and creating this whole new walk-up environment, those are the types of areas that I think stand to benefit from this concept and what, again, the market is demanding. So I think that means it's good news. It's good news for those areas that have been kind of out of the mix for a while, the areas that are of lower income.
We have an email from a listener named Carolyn who says, when I lived in Carlsbad, California, the stoplight crosswalks did not allow a right turn on red, and the pedestrians crossed all at the same time, utilizing the completely stopped traffic to allow the pedestrians to cross at a diagonal or across one street. Have you seen this, or would you consider this? Thank you, Carolyn. I mean, some of this, you think about it, that was making a right turn on red, and some places you can make a left turn on red now, too, was considered one of the great innovations of the 1970s as a driver ease. When we were, you know, the car culture really had come to its pinnacle. But we are talking about a new era now. Is there going to be some discussion about rolling back things like that?
Carolyn, I actually have been in Carlsbad last fall and was at that intersection where you can just cut diagonally across the street. It kind of, I think it's the second time I'd seen something like that, and it was amazing. Everybody could go every which way and cut across the street. It moves a lot of people very quickly. John, I think you're right. I think that might be worth talking about, the rollback of these right turn on reds, especially at the more denser, you know, walk-up type areas in downtown Indy, potentially in the Carmel area and Fishers. And one other plug I'll get is what Town of Speedway is doing as well with their Main Street and walk-up type community that they're creating out that way. So that trend there, and I love the thought of creating these kind of crosswalk things for people to be able to get a diagonally across streets or any direction. Yeah.
I'll just comment briefly. The pedestrian plan, again, which was adopted in early May by the Metropolitan Development Commission for Indianapolis and Marion County, includes nearly 40 recommendations of policies, practices, and programs that will help us improve walkability. And one of those specifically is to eliminate right turns on red in specific areas. And then it's a generalized recommendation, but to get at things like that, what we call them sometimes a scramble signal, where basically all car traffic stops and the pedestrians have free flow both directions within the intersection. And so there are none of those in Indianapolis that I'm aware of or in the region. There are not specific plans to put them anywhere, but it is now sort of officially in our toolbox of tools that will help us improve walkability.
And we're starting to get a little tight on time. We've gotten several questions by Charlie via Facebook and John by email, are probably the most prominent and most detailed ones about sidewalks.
Okay.
And really how there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of infrastructure planning for sidewalks thus far. And, you know, Charlie makes the point that having these great walkable areas isn't what it could be if you have to drive to get to them, if there are no safe ways for you to walk to arrive at them. Do we need to start thinking about sidewalk planning with the same sort of vigor that we do road planning and invest similar sums in making sure that there are sidewalks or at least walkable paths, walkable areas in most, if not all of the metro area? Kim, you're nodding your head up and down. Silence does not do well on radio. I need words.
Well, thank you for the question again and for bringing it up. And that is exactly the purpose of doing the pedestrian plan and getting it to this point. I want to say quickly, because it's extremely important, there is not money attached to implementing this PED plan. So there are project recommendations, there are high priority areas. There is not at this time money. And if we have time, I'll come back to that comment. What I want to say is that this is the first adopted pedestrian plan for the city of Indianapolis. So we have been doing transportation planning. We have been planning our roadways for, you know, decades, right?
Somebody in history?
Mm-hmm. In history. We have never had a pedestrian plan until 2016. And we're extremely proud that we have it now, right?
It took us 200 years.
It was a bicentennial win. Yeah. And in fact, it emerged early in the Plan 2020 process as something that needed to happen. Mm-hmm. So we're glad that we have been able to check that off. But I say check off lightly, because now the work of implementing that begins. And ultimately, we have to build more sidewalk infrastructure. We have to improve crossing infrastructure. And we have to invest in order to have walk-ups.
How much, we should talk about the money a little bit. I mean, for us to build these kinds of sidewalks, do we have any kind of dollar figure? Have we done any studies on what it would take to, because there is an absence of you know, sidewalks in a lot of neighborhoods around.
Yeah, I'm going to touch on, she'll jump in on the whole sidewalk issue because they're connected, you know, whether it's sidewalk to transit and then to rail, bicycle paths. I mean, those kinds of things, they're all connected, and that's the important message. But right now, out of the 100 top metros, Indianapolis ranks 83rd in the investment in its transit infrastructure. 83rd. And with this referendum that's coming up, we will jump to 65th. And I'm not sure. I'm like a competitive person that you know, 65th isn't good in almost anything, but it's a step in the right direction. So I only hope that our constituents will support that type of thing. But sure. And I'm sure there's going to be some hopefully carryover into this pedestrian plan.
Right. So the comment about the connectivity of all of the modes mm-hmm. is, again, fundamental. And so we need to provide options. That's been said over and over, and that is the focus. We have chronically and historically underinvested severely in anything except automobile travel by 99% to 1, probably 99.9 to 0.1 over the course of our lifetime. Even now, our state budget for transportation is about 95-96% into roads and highways and bridges, and 4%-ish in rail transit and walking and biking infrastructure. And so this imbalance, there's a term that we talk about in terms of balanced investment. And the reality is we will never achieve balance if we don't significantly increase the investment in walking, biking, and transit. The referendum and being able to hold that this November, again, hugely important. And because I'm able to say it, I will say it. We ask for your support as the public in voting yes on that. And if you're not sure about that, you're not confident in doing so, we want to be able to talk with you about that. But the other thing that the pedestrian plan really revealed, I think we knew it, but it put a very clear face on it, is that we have to have, as a community and as a region, some very hard conversations about our ability to invest in additional infrastructure.
Allocations of resources.
Absolutely.
And all of that. We've got a couple of questions from listeners real quickly because we are running out of time. But aside from voting on this, if you live in a neighborhood and you would like to make it more walkable, are there things residents can do for themselves to make a neighborhood more walkable?
One of the things, again, Chris mentioned in his presentations had to do with place management and how, if you think about the regional mall concept, which is becoming obsolete, all those have regional mall managers and marketing and budgets and those kinds of things to promote. Neighborhoods can do the same thing, and there was an example of one of the callers. So neighborhoods can do the same thing and drive some of these changes. Kim?
We can go to another.
No, go ahead.
I think that's a great answer.
That's, literally, that is the subject, because I think that's where I'm getting a lot of demand right now. I see right now. How do you enhance your own neighborhood to make it more walkable?
Sure. So, again, we sort of have an advocacy angle. And so one of the things that I always want to say is make sure that need, whether it's an absence of sidewalk altogether and it's needed or it needs to be fixed, make sure that has been reported to the city through the Mayor's Action Center or your own jurisdiction. Always letting your local elected officials know is extremely important. But again, as walkways, that's what we're here to help with. And so don't hesitate to reach out.
That, I'm afraid, will have to be the last word in this episode, but we're going to talk about this some more. I'd like to thank my guests and our listeners. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cerzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.